other interventions that too could interrupt virus transmission, such as wearing face masks. But some changes have forced a shift in our thinking about herd immunity. It's now viewed much more as an aspiration rather than an actual goal. Firstly, the evolution of the virus and the mutations that have occurred. One set of mutations made the virus much more transmissible or infectious. The Delta variant is just such an example. Initially, we thought the SARS-CoV-2 reproductive rate was between 2.5 and 4. In other words, in a fully susceptible population, every one person infected would on average infect about 2.5 to 4 other people. But the Delta variant is at least twofold more transmissible. That means that the reproductive rate of the Delta variant is probably closer to 6 rather than 3. The second change is that the virus has shown an ability to have mutations that make it resistant to antibody neutralizing activity induced by past infection from the original virus, as well as antibody responses induced by most of the current COVID-19 vaccines. The third big issue centers on the durability of protection. Our memory responses are lasting for at least 6 to 9 months at the moment, but that doesn't mean that they will protect us against infection from variants that are evolving, even if such memory responses do assist in attenuating the clinical course of the infection, leading to less severe COVID-19. The fourth issue, conspiring against us being able to reach a herd immunity threshold anytime soon, is the inequitable distribution of vaccines across the world, the slow uptake and the sluggish rollout. Unfortunately, this provides fertile ground for the ongoing evolution of the coronavirus. No country is going to lock its borders perpetually. This means the entire global population needs to reach the same sort of threshold around about the same time. At the moment, only 1% of the populations of low-income countries have been vaccinated, and 27% of the global population has been vaccinated. With the Delta variant, we would need to get close to 84% of the global population developing protection against infection in the absence of non-pharmacological interventions in as brief a period of time as possible. The only sustainable solution is to learn to live with the virus. This will require ensuring that we get the majority of individuals, especially adults, and particularly those at a higher risk of developing severe COVID-19 and dying, vaccinated as quickly as possible. In my view, this could be achieved in South Africa with 20 million people vaccinated, not the 40 million targets set by the government. But at 20 million, would need to include 90% of people above the age of 60 and 90% of people above the age of 35 who have comorbidities. If South Africa achieves this milestone, it could get back to a relatively normal lifestyle even with the virus continuing to circulate and causing the occasional outbreak. It would also ensure a threshold that guaranteed its healthcare systems weren't going to be overwhelmed and that people were not going to die in large numbers. We are simply going to have to become comfortable with the idea that SARS-CoV-2 is going to be like one of the numerous other viruses that circulate that cause respiratory illness each day. Usually mild infections and less often a severe disease. So people will unfortunately continue dying of COVID-19, but certainly not at the magnitude that's been seen over the past 18 months. A major advance would be for COVID-19 to be no more severe than what is seen every influenza season, 10,000 to 11,000 deaths in South Africa. The British experience is where we should be heading, that is, getting back to a relatively normal lifestyle, provided that we have an adequate number of people vaccinated, and particularly people who are at higher risk of developing severe COVID-19. The United Kingdom is now close to 85% of adults that have already received at least a single dose of the vaccine. As a result, they're able to remove almost all restrictions. The United Kingdom is seeing an increase in the number of cases of the Delta variant of the coronavirus, but they've seen very nominal changes when it comes to hospitalization and death. The vast majority of people, 97%, who still end up being hospitalized are dying of COVID-19 in the United Kingdom are those who decided not to be vaccinated.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Revive the Spirit of Quran. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. In earlier times, Quran was a book of guidance for people. But now, it has been turned into a book of pride. Today, we need to once again make the Quran a book of guidance for ourselves. This requires Muslims to revise the policies and activities in which they are currently engaged. In the madrasas and mosques, for instance, sermons given are generally centered on the form of religion. In Muslim congregations, it is only the form or the outward aspects of religion that is discussed. We have to return to the original spirit of Islam. This can be understood from a saying of Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The Prophet is reported to have said that in later times, mosques would be full of worshippers but devoid of guidance. This means in the later period of Islam, people will perform all rituals associated with religion, but their worship would lack inner spirit. Instead of focusing on reviving the spirit of Islam in individual believers, present-day Muslims only speak about working towards gaining political power, which they think is the solution for bringing about a change. Political power is important in Islam, but with its Islamic spirit. The worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is important in Islam, but with its proper spirit. And similarly, Quran is a source of pride for Muslims, but what is more important is the spirit of Quran. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing reviving the spirit of Holy Quran. Quran is there. We love Quran. We read Quran. We respect Quran. But do we try to keep alive the spirit of Quran? Is a million-dollar question for all of us. A brief glance over history would be enough to provide sufficient proof of the claim that there has been no such book that has ever influenced human societies to the magnitude of the Quran. It is for the same reason that the Quran automatically steps into the precincts of sociological discussions and becomes the elemental constituent of the subjects of research in this discipline. This means that any deep study and profound research in the field of world history of the last 1400 years is impossible without the knowledge of the Holy Quran. If you want to research and have a proper perspective, have a proper vision of what humanity is all about, of what the creation of Allah is all about, of what this universe is all about, you need Quran for that. Quran is that absolute truth that takes you closer to the realities of this world. So no matter what you want to study, you need Quran for that. You know, in order to get to those higher levels of understanding. Yes, you can have a superficial understanding of any sciences without Quran, even Islamic sciences. But you need Holy Quran to take you to that higher level of understanding of all of those knowledges and sciences. So keep in mind, stay connected to the Holy Quran. It is here to guide us. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The UK government, heir to a party that, like the Republicans in the United States, has not hesitated to cut social infrastructure spending and to impose austerity budgets on the poor in recent decades, promised to soup up spending on everything from cybersecurity to nuclear weapons, says Sasha Bromsky, journalist, in an article titled UK is embarking on largest military spending hike since Cold War. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Late last year, with the pandemic in full brutal swing, Boris Johnson's Conservative government in the UK announced a nearly £17 billion, what was then $21.9 billion increase in military spending. The increase spread over 4 years, represented the largest hike in defense investments since the end of the Cold War. And while it was a tiny fraction of what the U.S. spends annually on defense, made clear Britain's ambition to be seen as a global military superpower once more. In an era of escalating tensions between a U.S.-led NATO and Russia, and during a period in which economic competition between China and the West is increasingly morphing into a high-stakes arms race, Britain's move to ramp up military spending made clear that the UK won't be sitting out these new global struggles. In fact, the UK decision to escalate military investments was based on an evolving military doctrine of constant competition with adversaries that would keep opponents off balance, while, hopefully, staying just clear of provocations that could lead to war. The UK government, heir to a party that's like the Republicans in the United States, has not hesitated to cut social infrastructure spending and to impose austerity budgets on the poor. In recent decades, promised to soup up spending on everything from cybersecurity to nuclear weapons. In March, the government announced it would raise the cap on the number of warheads the country possessed by a staggering 40%, and that it would no longer make public the number of operational nuclear weapons that it controlled. Critics argued to no avail that this would undermine the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to which Britain is a signatory. Folded into the new, more aggressive military posture were changes that went far beyond the nuclear arsenal. Johnson's government unveiled plans for advanced new naval systems, set up a new space command, and committed to large investments in futuristic artificial intelligence. As a part of this new posture in which post-Brexit Britain isolated from its half-century-long relationship to the EU, or what was formerly known as the European Economic Community, and the power brokers on the continent, takes on increasingly confrontational military policing roles globally and regionally. The UK recently sent an aircraft carrier and broader naval strike group into South China Sea. The vessels, part of an international effort ostensibly designed to preserve freedom of navigation in contested international waters, sailed between Singapore and the Philippines, deliberately coming within a few miles of contested islands claimed by China in the region. This follows on the heels of another venture in which the UK sent a Navy strike force into the waters off Crimea, territory annexed by Russia in 2014. One can well make the baseless claim that both Russia and China are taking deeply irresponsible actions on the world stage. Yet, acceptance of that critique is different from acceptance of the desirability of giving Boris Johnson's government carte blanche to launch whatever military adventures it chooses to embark upon. In fact, Johnson's government, seeking to shore up its right-wing populist credentials, seems now to want to reach for military solutions even against recent allies. This spring, in one of the stranger post-Brexit moments, the Brits began scrambling up naval vessels against French and other EU fishers in the English Channel. The vessels were rushed off to the island of Jersey and were apparently aimed at breaking a blockade of the local waters by fishers from the continent. Irate that their long-standing right to fish these waters had now been terminated. In the end, both sides stood down, but the very notion that the UK and France could come to the edge of a naval confrontation over fishing rights, with the British government egged on by a snarling, far-right, flag-worshipping tabloid press, is simply astounding and shows exactly how far Britain has veered off course since the Brexit of 2016 set in motion the years-long process of divorce between the UK and its erstwhile partners within the European Union. French fishing vessels haven't been the only targets of the British military in the seas abutting Britain. For much of the past year, as Johnson's government has ramped up its rhetorical and legal campaigns against asylum seekers, ultra-sophisticated military drones have patrolled British waters, looking for migrants desperately trying to enter the country's waters on rafts. The arms build up, and Britain's growing willingness to needle opponents militarily is, to say the least, disconcerting. Yet, it isn't exactly a development out of the blue. For while Britain has, for most of its modern history, steered clear of maintaining large standing armies during peacetime, it hasn't hesitated to use its naval assets to secure global influence. In fact, in many ways, the UK's new doctrine of constant competition and ongoing military assertiveness is a souped-up version of a mid-19th century imperial doctrine, gunboat diplomacy, perfected by statesmen such as Lord Palmerston as a way to realize British ambitions around the world without actually triggering war with the other behemoth on the global stage. Palmerston was a master of the art of military populism. He routinely sent gunboats to potential flashpoints while talking about the military muscle flexing as simply being a defense of British values of liberty, democracy, and freedom. The press and much of the British public relished these shows of force, and for many years, Palmerston bestrode the halls of Westminster, first as Foreign Secretary and then as Prime Minister. He relied on Britain's raw power to impose his views, but, as importantly, he relied on bluster, in the sense that he was just gung-ho enough, just trigger-happy enough, to follow through on his threats, to convince opponents that ceding to Britain would serve their interest better than forcing an actual fight. Today, Johnson is reimagining British diplomacy in a similar way. His government pledged to cut international aid from 0.7% of the gross national income to 0.5%, and recently won a parliamentary vote on the issue. Despite former Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May joining with a group of rebel members of Parliament to vote against Johnson's plan. Yet, even as his government slashes overseas aid in a cruel effort to balance a budget-falling stimulus measures designed to counter the economic impact of the pandemic, it increases military spending. Britain is now the only G7 country cutting rather than increasing its international aid commitments. It is, at the same time, spending more on its military than any other G7 member, apart from the United States, making it the fifth highest military spender on the planet. In 2020, Germany spent 1.4% of its GDP on its military, and France itself, in the middle of a significant military build-up, spent 2.1%. Britain, by contrast, spent 2.2%. This combination of withdrawal from non-military international obligations and high-profile military spending speaks volumes for the priorities of post-Brexit Britain. Moreover, it speaks volumes about the values underpinning Johnson's particularly noxious brand of right-wing nationalistic populism.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islam, my deen.
Islam, my deen.
Allah, my Lord.
Allah, my Lord.
He's
Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Salaam alaikum to you, Brother Habib.
Welcome, dear listeners. Welcome to Youth Station. You guys are listening to Brother Habib and his most favorite co-host, Brother Muafi. Brother Muafi, salaam alaikum.
Yeah, salaam alaikum.
Thank you for coming, Brother
Rahim. And thank you very much for inviting me.
We're still living in the pandemic.
Yeah.
And it's affected us in all different, you know, in all our life aspects. You know, even school, again, there's this talk here that it's going to be also online. And me personally, I hated it online.
Why?
Because my students, one of them was asleep, one of them was eating, one of them was without a shirt and listening to my lectures. So,
what's wrong with it, man?
The internet, when it gets weak, all right. Two words, three words. I don't know about, you know, academic things, but in Hausa, two or three words, you miss out on the entire topic. Because there are three main words. So with the weak internet, with, you know, you always have to keep your phone charged, you're at your house. And when you're at your house, you're comfortable. You're sitting down. Your children are playing around. Your wife is making breakfast. And you want to listen, pay attention. What is he stating in Al-Kifaya?
This is the non-hypocritical way of life, I guess. Because you live out your life according to reality, bro.
So it means that we're hypocritical when we're paying attention in our classes.
No, basically, this is the way we live in our houses, bro. Why is something wrong with it?
That how can you put your class, your knowledge, with your house? It doesn't go together. I believe that when you want to study, it has to be a special environment, even in your house. When you make it, you have to make a special environment. And for me,
to be honest with you, when I'm teaching, I don't care whether my students are wearing shirts or not. Whether they are drinking, whether they are eating, whether they are what. What I care about is their attention, all right? Their mind is for me.
We're wearing masks. Our ears are even affected. You know the back of your ear because of the mask?
Exactly.
It hurts.
They get like wounded or something.
Mm. The question here is, as a Muslim, how does it affect your faith?
Well, as you mentioned, or it was clear, or the kind of impression that everyone can get from the first words of our talk, you know, was something that not only our life has been affected by this pandemic, but also our religion has been to a very great extent.
The practical or the, you know, the belief aspect, the creed aspect?
No, the practical aspect, the ritual side of the story, you know?
Exactly.
Like, for example, imagine that how many times we used to go to the mosque and fill the ranks of the congregational prayers.
Yeah.
But today, you can't do that very easily. Or even if for those cities, for those countries where there were a lot of vaccinations going on, or some of these lockdown or limitation and restrictions have been lifted off those regions, they may find it hard to get back to return to that kind of a state, to that normal state they used to live, all right? We used to go there like a happy-go-lucky person. Mm. With no worries whatsoever. But today you can't really be that relaxed. Max and relax, you know? And you have to all the time carry with you this kind of stress. You're under a lot of stress that this kind of disease or the other, this COVID-19 or one of its variants, like Delta, Alpha, Beta, whatsoever, you know, that comes along with it and after it in concession. This is something quite bothering me all the time, you know? And I'm not a very sensitive person, by the way. When I look at my sister, when I look at the other people around me, they have like sprays of alcohol around them, you know? They spray here and there. Whenever they touch the handle of the doorknobs or something, they spray it all on and on. One of the worst things that happened to people and it was imposed on them was the expenditure that they have to have for buying these stuff.
Yeah.
All right?
There were even, you know, charity organizations that were making COVID-19 packs to actually distribute to families in need because it's so expensive.
There it is.
Tissues, sanitizers, you know.
Masks.
Masks and whatnot.
And liquid, washing liquids and stuff like that, you know. So I guess to a very large extent, We all have been hit. We all have been affected by this pandemic in all aspects and arenas of life, including religion. But you made a very nice point, a very fine point or difference between the practical aspect and
the creed
or theoretical aspect.
Yeah.
No, I'm not talking about the theoretical aspect. The theoretical aspect that stays there, on and on. But what I'm talking about is the way we used to pray. The way...
We go to our lectures to gain more spirit, to gain more knowledge.
Yes, the way we used to do the things basically in our life have been affected.
They have been affected, yeah, true. Yes. No one can deny that. The thing here is that some people may, you know, from the fear of corona, from, you know, they might have this look that their creed also fades away. But if you want the honesty, when you return to history, you see, this is not the first time that a pandemic has hit an Islamic country and Islamic rule.
Mm-hmm.
We go back to the 13th century in the Hijri calendar.
Yes.
They also were hit. Qazwin was hit with a big, you know...
Plague.
With a big plague. And they even had to shut down the Hawza, the Islamic seminaries there. Some of them, the plague even happened in Najaf and in Karbala. And... like how we see today, people have different ways of, you know, acting with the plague. Some of them run away. Some of them stay at their houses.
Yes.
There are even people during the time of the plague in Najaf where they used to go every Friday with their families, wear white, and go to the haram of Amir al-Mu'min alayhi salam to pray, to be protected from the plague.
And also, not to mention Hajj. The Hajj rituals have been like banned for 2 years now,
yeah.
Right? And we are in the month of Zulhijjah, right?
Yeah.
And they do it, in fact, quite separately and with, health protocols all along. And this is something that we have never seen in our life.
Yeah,
this is quite new.
It's always going to be history. This is always going to be in history. And like how the past plagues have been in history, it's been written about, the way they affected even the... path, you know, because we're going to see this a lot, especially in the academic part of the religion.
Yes.
And because like how we have this in school, because I know kindergartners who had online classes,
mm-hmm.
and I'm doing online classes by, you know, closing my two fingers and then opening them again, because they're not classes. The kids are just looking at a phone and then they go off. They don't know how to read. They don't know how to write.
Mm-hmm.
Kids in you know, vital stages in their schools, in elementary or in middle school or in high school, they're in vital places in their studies. They're not going to have that best, you know, that same study. We even have college students. Just imagine a doctor, and he tells you that, yeah, I got a degree online because of the pandemic, and I'm going to give you a heart surgery. Me personally, I would be in fear if someone was going to give me a heart surgery, and the way that he got his certificate to do heart surgery was online.
Mm-hmm.
So the same thing with, you know, Islamic seminary, the same thing with... with the way that the publications of books, the lectures that we have, the touch between the students of the talaba inside the house, I think it's also going to be affected. It has its effect on us.
Yes, true indeed.
So, brother, let's take a short break.
Sure.
We'll be back to continue talking about the topic. Brothers and sisters, please stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Youth Station.
Salaam alaikum and welcome back. Thank you guys for joining us again. You guys are listening to Youth Station, broadcasting from IRIB English Radio Station with me, Brother Habib, and Brother Muhammad Jawad. And we were talking about how Corona has affected our faith during these times. And we've been through this pandemic for quite a while. It's been like, I don't know why it feels like 10 years. It's only been like 3 years. And, you know, like 2 years, actually. Two in a couple of months. And yet it feels so long.
It's not 2 years yet, but the thing is we are closing on it.
It feels a long time. It feels like a long time.
Yeah, exactly, like a long time.
Yeah.
You know, Brother Habib, we talked about all of the negative aspects, usually, in the first part of our show, right? When we were talking about the kind of impact coronavirus, this COVID-19, this ominous virus had on our lives, including our religion and religious aspect and practical aspect of our religion and faith. But let me draw your attention to something also promising and positive, ultimately.
All right.
All right. You know, there is so much talk about loneliness that people get and frustration as a result of COVID-19's lockdown.
Yeah, restrictions. All
right? These restrictions have caused a lot of people, in fact, to have a go of, which we call it, frustration and what do you call it, a kind of pessimism and
depression.
Depression. And they always look at it very much negatively because they feel lonely when they are at home, when they are like at home by force. This is something imposed on them. This is something not optional, all right? When you, it's optional for you, you may stay at home like for a month or two, all right? Without even batting an eyelash. But the thing is, when it's forced on you,
you're restricted and someone's ordering you.
It's like the forbidden fruit,
yeah.
Basically.
I want to go outside.
Yeah, you want to go outside. And if you can't because of laws and regulations, because of the fine, because of like the police offices or something, then you're going to feel something shivering down your spine, you know? Mm. The thing is, they look at it from a very negative aspect, all right? They feel lonely. But the thing is, what I'm trying to say, what I'm trying to draw your attention to is the positive aspect of this. You know, we have been very much connected, like to other people, too much connected, basically, all right? And if we, like, find ourselves alone at home, we have nothing to do. So we have to think about this.
Boredom. Right?
No, I'm not talking about boredom.
But the
I'm
free time that you have.
The free time and the management you can have of this free time. In other words, you have to budget your time.
True.
All right? You have to program your life one way or another. And also, in addition to this, you have to plan your life, program your life in a way that you can take advantage of it. Right? This is a kind of opportunity knocking on the door. And you have to take it, not only take it like by force or reluctantly. No, you have to do it willingly, all right? And look at the positive side of the story. Look at silence you can have. You know, we had so much emphasis in our religion, not only in our religion, also in Buddhism, all right? In Hinduism, there is so much emphasis on, meditation. And meditation comes along with silence. Of course, they talk about silence in different forms. They have four stages of silence in Buddhism. And that is one of the best and most complicated forms of silence that we have in human heritage of knowledge. Mm. All right? The thing is, silence in and of itself is very much positive and healthy for people. Through silence, you can also meditate. Through silence, you can think of yourself. You can think of your own actions and your own theories. Through silence, you can do a lot of things that might not be or might not have been possible before. All right? And without silence, you cannot think of those things. You cannot think of yourself, your heart, your religion, every belief that you have with the belief system or by which you can build a belief system. And we have to think about all of those like bricks that make a wall of our belief system. All right?
Yeah.
If you think like from not top to bottom, this time from bottom to top, basically. All right? Maybe you can think again.
Brothers and sisters, I hope you guys enjoy the show. From me and brother Muhammad Jawad, we're signing off from Youth Station Broadcasting only on Arab English Radio Station. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you.
in the limelight.
The illegal Zionist entity will definitely vanish from the world map, and judging from its recent suicidal attempts in southern Lebanon, coupled with the suicidal remarks of Premier Naftali Bennett and War Minister Benny Gantz, it will be the most horrible end that any criminal regime has ever met in history. It is only a matter of time for the fake regime of Israel to cease its illegal existence on the soil of Palestine. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Keihan International. This article is published under the heading Zionist Regime's Suicidal Moves. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. It seems the grave is ready, and the corpse, on life support for the past several decades, tired of its precarious survival, is yearning for burial, or more properly, cremation, since the fast approaching end is likely to be the combustible, which means no need for any undertakers. Yes, the illegal Zionist entity called Israel will definitely vanish from the world map, and judging from its recent suicidal attempts in southern Lebanon, coupled with the suicidal remarks of Premier Naftali Bennett and War Minister Benny Gantz, it will be the most horrible end that any criminal regime has ever met in history. Emboldened by its almost daily brutalities against the unarmed residents of Beit al-Muqaddas, its frequent battering of the defenseless, stone-throwing people of the West Bank, and its sporadic air raids on the besieged Gaza enclave, where the retaliatory rockets of defenders have not yet acquired the power to thoroughly pummel the occupiers, the Zionist entity, earlier this week, made the folly to test the patience of Lebanon's legendary anti-terrorist movement, the Hezbollah. The response was swift. Around 20 short-range projectiles were fired as warning shots by the Lebanese defenders, who could well have destroyed the enemy military base on the occupied Sheba farms, but chose to target the nearby uninhabited areas as warning shots. The harebrained Israelis, however, again miscalculated by firing artillery shells at a time when, with the backing of their godfathers in Washington and London, they intend to provoke the Islamic Republic of Iran by thundering threats. The reply from Tehran was to the point. General Hossein Salami, the chief of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, IRGC, said, "We are all prepared for the showdown." Other senior commanders have also warned the Zionists against playing with fire in the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman region by blaming Iran for supposed attacks on commercial shipping. IRGC head of the Aerospace Division, Brigadier General Amir Ali Hajizadeh, made it clear, "The enemies have tested us before and know what response they will face. We have both the power and the will to exercise power. We will certainly deliver a harsh response, and they cannot make such a mistake. Let us wait and see how the Zionist entity and its criminal backers behave. One wrong move, and without the least doubt, the Zionist regime will be a thing of the past." Meanwhile, the resistance front, stretching from Palestine to Syria and from Iraq to Yemen, which lauded Lebanon's Hezbollah for its retaliatory steps, has issued separate statements to warn the Zionist entity of their collective power that is capable of liberating not just the Sheba Farms and the Golan Heights, but all of Beit al-Muqaddas. Yes, it is only a matter of time for the fake regime of Israel to cease its illegal existence on the soil of Palestine.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate, June 4, 2021. The televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. The kind of Islam that Imam wanted. From the viewpoint of Imam, Islam is a system that seeks justice and that it is opposed to arrogance and corruption. These are clear in the statements of Imam. These statements can be found both in his testament and in the 20 plus volumes on Imam's statements, both of which have been published. Of course, we ourselves heard these viewpoints directly from Imam, but those who were not born then and who did not see Imam could refer to his statements. The context of Imam's statements is clear. The kind of Islam that Imam believes in is anti-arrogance, that is, anti-American. It is against the domination and interference of foreigners and foreign powers, interference in the domestic affairs of the country. It is against kneeling before the enemy. It is an anti-corruption Islam. The kind of Islam that Imam believes in is anti-corruption and is opposed to giving privileges to certain individuals. The things that are revealed in the area of corruption in some sectors today are definitely the opposite of what Islam wants. Islam is a religion that fights against corruption. An Islamic government is a government that combats corruption. Such a government is also anti-reactionary. Reactionary meaning contaminating life with old regressive thoughts and drifting away from new Islamic thoughts. Those of our magnanimous Imam. Islam is hostile to aristocracy and advocates the underprivileged. Islam does not favor class inequalities, the gap between the poor and the rich. Late in his blessed life, a few months before his demise, Imam writes a letter to an official saying, "You should show that our people rose up against oppression, chaos, reactionary attitude, and retro-regressive ideas, and that they replaced a monarchic, capitalist, eclectic, and in some, an American Islam with an original Islam introduced by Muhammad."
The Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, said that the recent Israeli attack was a very dangerous development, which has not occurred in the last 15 years, stressing that the resistance needed to respond swiftly.
Our response was linked directly to the two incidents of Israeli Air Force attacks, which targeted Lebanese territory for the first time in 15 years. And our response had very clear tools and objectives. We calculated our moves very precisely. Our enemy and our friends said this. They said open territory. They did not target civilians. So we also targeted open areas with no civilians. But we had many options. We could hit open areas in Sheba Farms, in northern occupied Palestine, or the occupied Golan Heights.
Said Hassan Nasrallah made the remarks in a televised speech to commemorate the 15th anniversary of the 2006 war. He said that Israel deliberately targeted open areas in the middle of the night in order to terrorize civilians, and presumed that the resistance would not respond because of the various domestic problems inside Lebanon. Said Nasrallah stressed that the main deterrence for Israel is the capabilities of the resistance.
The enemy today is more fearful than any time in the past because of the developments in Palestine and the region and the transformations in the region and the ascending strength of the resistance and because of the deep internal divisions and the mutual hatred between the occupying Zionist groups. Facing their internal issues and the strengthening of the resistance, everyone in the Zionist entity is talking about an existential threat.
Experts believe the military potential of Hezbollah has created a balance of deterrence where Israel is incapable of even starting a war.
Israel wants Hezbollah to start the war. The situation will be different. Hezbollah is aware of this, will not Israel let him go to war, you know, anytime Israel wanted.
The leader of Lebanon's resistance noted that in any future confrontation, the Israeli military will disintegrate completely and would be heavily defeated. The 2006 war had settled a certain status quo, which remains until today, with a new regional equation, which comprises all the resistance groups in the region. Any miscalculation by the Israelis could be detrimental for Israel. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Visiting the famous Eiffel Tower in Paris has become more complicated than before. Now, people have to show an electronic document that proves that they are vaccinated twice. If not, they need to show a negative PCR test. However, most of the visitors do not consider this procedure as a problem.
It's a good opportunity to show that you're vaccinated. For me, this is perfect. This way, we are all sure that we are vaccinated.
I'm fine with it. I mean, if it lets us do things like this, then why not? To go back to some kind of normal, being able to spend time with our family, go on vacation, it's nice.
The same procedure is used to visit public places like the Louvre Museum. Rows are longer than usual because people have to show their pass.
I'm rather in favor of the health pass. If it is to protect everyone and to prevent the virus from spreading, that's better for everybody.
The French Parliament and Senate have voted this new law, and earlier this week, the Constitutional Council has approved the law text. The health pass will now be extended also to restaurants and trains. But protesters continue taking the streets. They were again tens of thousands in France and at least 2,000 in Paris. Why? Jerome Rodriguez, who lost his eye in a previous protest, organized this march. He explains that the problem is not the vaccination, but the limitation of liberties.
We are here to protest against the violation and decline of liberties in France. We are not here against the vaccines. The health pass is just one extra restrictive law after another. The first restrictive law was against the Yellow Vests, the second one about global security, and now the third with the health pass. Macron should take care of the poor people, not only of the rich companies who earned a lot of money during this COVID crisis.
The protesters are especially targeting the French government that is using force rather than persuasion to obtain a double vaccination of a large majority of the French. The reason is medical. Today, most of the people who arrive in hospitals with severe symptoms of the COVID-19 virus are not vaccinated. Most of the people who transmit the virus are not vaccinated either. Despite ongoing protests against the mandatory health pass, the majority of the French is bowing more and more to the medical evidence. Today, vaccination is the only efficient way to hold back the coronavirus. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
This is Pin Baldak, a Kiefgan border crossing in southwest of Pakistan. North Alban have shut it down, demanding Pakistan a visa-free movement of Afghan citizens. The complete closure of the border has suspended transportation of edible items and movement of thousands of people from both sides. The Taliban recaptured most of the border crossing with the neighboring countries of Afghanistan in an attempt to lay down a siege of President Ashraf Ghani's beleaguered government in capital Kabul.
Islamabad has completed 90% of wide fence of nearly 2,700 kilometer long porous border with Afghanistan to contain the movement of terrorists sneaking into Pakistan to carry out terrorist attacks. If visa restriction is removed, Islamabad fears there would be more infiltration of terrorists into Pakistan. Therefore, the government here is unlikely to concede to the Taliban demand of a visa-free movement of Afghan citizens.
It's not a legitimate government who can come up with a legitimate demand or where it can ask a relationship which is based state to state. It has to legitimize itself. It has to bring itself to an acceptable and internationally recognized position.
The Taliban claim to have recaptured 85% of Afghan territory, controlling over 260 districts, most of which after the withdrawal of US-led NATO forces. The clashes between the Taliban fighters and Afghan National Army have made thousands of families homeless, and many of them were caught in the crossfire, particularly in the southern parts of Afghanistan. The UN has warned an unfolding humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan.
The provincial capitals of Kandahar, Herat, and Lashkargah, in particular, have come under significant pressure. This is a clear attempt by the Taliban to seize urban centers with the force of arms.
The ongoing talks between Taliban and President Ashraf Ghani's government in Doha have so far failed to take